Welcome to the America Magazine podcast. America Magazine is the national Catholic weekly. Visit us online at www.americamagazine.org.
Hello, this is Tim Reedy for the America Magazine podcast. I'm joined this week by Monsignor Tom Shelley from the Archdiocese of New York, who teaches at Fordham University in the theology department. He's a historian, and well, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me, Tim.
Monsignor Shelley has a new book out on the occasion of the 200th anniversary of the Archdiocese of New York, called The Bicentennial History of the Archdiocese of New York. And this has just been published, and we're right in April 2008, so we're right in the 200th year. Before that period, 1808, when the Archdiocese was officially established, there were, of course, Catholics in New York before that period. So we thought we could begin this discussion by talking about some of those folks. Who were some of the notable Catholics who first arrived in the New York area?
The first real Catholic presence, I'd say, dates from the 1640s with the French Jesuit missionaries from Canada, particularly Isaac Jogues, and those two laymen, Jean de Lalande and René Goupil, all three of whom were martyred in the 1640s. I said for most of the colonial period, Catholics were certainly not welcome in New York. The exception was that brief period when the governor or the owner or the proprietor of the colony was the Duke of York, who later became James II as king. And in 1685, he sent a Irish Catholic to New York as the governor, Thomas Dongan. And Dongan issued this Charter of Privileges and Liberties that gave religious freedom to at least to all Christians in the colony. So I'd say for that brief period, the 1680s, Catholics did enjoy considerable religious freedom. For example, Dongan brought over three English Jesuits who opened a little Latin school. There was a chapel in the what then was called Fort James, where the battery would be today. But that all comes to an end in 1688, 1689, with the Glorious Revolution in England. And then from 1700 to 1776, there was a law that barred Catholics, from 1700 to 1784, a law that barred any priest from setting foot in the colony. Around 1690, the governor said that he only knew of nine Catholics in the whole colony. So I say, except for those Jesuit missionaries, Thomas Dongan, the record of Catholics in colonial New York is really very meager. They're few and far between for understandable reasons.
So then we're going to fast forward a bit. So once we get out of the colonial period into the early years of our country's history, the Archdiocese was founded in 1808. So who was the first bishop of New York?
Well, the first bishop was Richard Luke Kincannon, an Irishman living in Rome who was appointed bishop and never got here because of the Napoleonic Wars. John O'Connor liked to say he was the smartest bishop of New York, precisely because he didn't come here. But I'd just like to back up a bit and point out, after 1784, it was theoretically possible, not just theoretically, but it was possible for Catholics to practice their faith openly for the first time in almost a century. And 1784, 1785, a group of laymen organized the first parish, St. Peter's Church on Berkeley Street. And by 1786, they had a small brick building, which was really the first church in all of New York State. And it remains today the oldest Catholic parish in the York. And I should mention, 1808, the Diocese of New York was established.
Okay.
Carved out of the Archdiocese of Baltimore.
Baltimore. Right.
And then in 1850, it became an archdiocese. But you ask about the early leadership. Bishop Kincannon never came here. I say he died in 1810 in Naples, which is as close as he got. And then for the next 5 years, there's no one in charge, really, because the Pope was a prisoner of Napoleon, and one of the ways he reacted to that is by refusing to appoint new bishops. So although the diocese was started in 1808, there was no bishop here until the second bishop arrived in 1815. But since this is a Jesuit publication, not only for that reason, I wanted to mention for those early years when there was no bishop, the vicar general or the man who really started the diocese was this Anthony Coleman, an Alsatian Jesuit who was the vicar general to John Carroll in Baltimore. He started New York's second Catholic parish, St. Patrick's Old Cathedral. He also started the first Catholic college, if I can call it that, which was called the New York Literary Institute. And unfortunately, he was called back to Georgetown to staff Georgetown College. But in many ways, Colpin has a good claim to be considered the real founder of the diocese. And he was a very capable man.
Yes, Father Colman, in fact, Cardinal Egan spoke about him when he gave, when he presided over a recent Jesuit Jubilee Mass. He spoke in his homily about Father Colman and his, what an instrumental role he played in the founding of the diocese. So,
yeah, he did. And he insisted the future of the society had more to gain in New York than it did in Georgetown.
Interesting.
Yes.
So then we're moving along to 1815. Is that when the first bishop actually arrived on our shores?
Exactly. This is Bishop John Connolly, who was 67 or 68 years old, another Irish Dominican who happened to be living in Rome for the previous 40 years or so. And it was an incredible, an incredibly inept appointment. Before, I mean, here's a man who's had a desk job in Rome for 40 years, and at what in our society today would be retirement age, he's plunked down in the middle of the wilderness, a diocese that consisted of the whole state of New York and half of New Jersey. He had no pastoral experience. It was a dreadful appointment. And no one thought so more than John Carroll, who was annoyed no end that he was not consulted about the appointment of Connolly.
And how long was he there for?
10 years. It's a wonder he survived. I mean, when he got here, he had three churches in all of New York State, two in New York City, one in Albany. He had about six priests, but they came and went. I mean, most of these people were just, you know, what John Carroll referred to as part of the wandering clerical fraternity. I mean, they just wandered in and out of the diocese, and often enough, their bishop was glad to get rid of them. So the obstacles that he faced were just enormous. And then remember, 1817, you had the beginning of the Erie Canal. And it's not really true it was dug entirely by Irish laborers, but at least towards the end, maybe a quarter of the people who were engaged in building or digging that canal were Irish immigrants, many of them Catholics. So the Catholic population really swelled. But quite honestly, poor Connolly was just unable to keep pace with the growth, with the challenges he had to face. One of his most severe critics was a fellow bishop, John England, the Bishop of Charleston, who said, I mean, he was a wonderful priest, a great man in his monastery, but he had no idea what was going on in America.
And this would happen many times since. He was not a native-born American, obviously. He was from Ireland, and there were a number of Irish priests and Irish bishops who came over here. Now, we're going to fast forward a little bit. Unfortunately, we can't discuss each of the bishops of New York, but the big one, the first major one, is Archbishop John Hughes. Now, when was he appointed?
Well, he was appointed as the coadjutor to Bishop Dubois, who, incidentally, of the 11 bishops and archbishops of New York, Dubois was the only one who was not Irish or of Irish descent.
Ah.
He was French. He died in 1842, and the experiment has not been repeated. Poor Dubois, again, he was really, quite frankly, a rather inept administrator. And also, it was no fault of his, he wasn't Irish, and the fact that an Irishman wasn't appointed was enormously resented by the local Irish Catholic community, who gave him a very, very hard time. You know that story, which supposedly is true, he said, after I'm dead, bury me under the sidewalk in front of the cathedral so people can walk over me in death as they did in life.
This is the old cathedral, right?
Yes, yeah. And actually he was buried there. But look, Hughes is really a very significant figure. Came here in 1838. As a coadjutor, ordinarily he'd have no authority whatsoever, only whatever authority Bishop Dubois gave him. And by 1839, Dubois' health had begun to fail, both physically and mentally, and Rome appointed Hughes as the administrator of the diocese. So in effect, from 1839 till 1864, Hughes is really running the Diocese of New York, and he's the first really capable bishop. What he found, I mean, right after he came here, he looked around the place. He said to a friend of his, Bishop Purcell in Cincinnati, he said, I think I've been sent here in punishment for my sins. And he complained about the lack of priests, the low caliber of the clergy. I think there were 10 churches in New York, he said. The mortgages on them was greater than the value of the churches themselves. He inherited, really, a chaotic diocese. And it was he who really pulled it together and laid the foundations of what becomes, in 1850, the Archdiocese of New York. And as John Tracy Ellis used to always say, when you're dealing with somebody like that, you need to have a balance sheet, the pluses and the minuses. And there were plenty of things to put on both sides of the balance sheet, believe me. He described himself once as bishop in chief. And I mean, and that was his approach. He brooked no opposition. There's a very good book on American Catholicism before the Civil War by Jay Dolan, which was recently retired from Notre Dame. But he says, you know, treated his flock like an Irish chieftain. I mean, nobody had to ask who was in charge of the church in New York. It was Hughes. And that had strengths, but it also had many weaknesses, obviously.
Well, his nickname, was Dagger John Hughes. So, and he sort of set the tone. I mean, there were other archbishops that would follow him that would have a similar reputation. So he was here for over 20 years?
Well, 25 years.
25 years. And he was also instrumental in founding Fordham University, am I correct?
He was, yes. I mean, everyone is aware of his interest in parochial schools, but he also was very much interested in providing a college for the, you know, rising Catholic middle class. And he saw that as the way for these immigrants to, you know, climb out of this cycle of poverty. When he started Fordham, or St. John's College, he bought the property. It was over 100 acres for $30,000. There was a frame building and then what is now the administration building on the property. He didn't have the $30,000 he needed to pay for the land and then fix up these two buildings. So he had to go to Europe to try to raise the money. That's how poor the diocese was. But Hughes deserves to be remembered for that, as well as for his interest in Catholic education. One of the things that made him a national figure is this knockdown, drag-out fight he had with the Public School Society, which was a private Protestant organization funded by the state that had a monopoly of public education in New York City. And he got involved in, I say, a knockdown, drag-out fight with that public school society, and he beat them. And it's an incredible story. And doing this book, I delved into that more than I ever had done before. And I didn't realize until recently the full dimensions of that. I mean, he took on both the Whig Party as well as the local Democrats. And he forced the Democrats, really, to reverse their stand on that. Now, again, as everybody knows, it was something of an empty victory because he ended the monopoly of the public school society, but part of the result was eventually a secularized public school system, which is not what he wanted or intended.
Terry Galway, who's edited a book on Catholics in New York also for the Bicentennial, said in an event that I attended last night that Hughes was more interested in building walls than bridges, and I think that's what you were getting at there, that building these institutions, he was creating what became what we were familiar with as the Catholic institutions, churches. You know, looking through this book, it's amazing how many institutions the New York Church built over the years, and that started with Archbishop Hughes.
Yes, I know. I think that's a fair enough description, but I do think you need to keep in mind, as John Tracy Ellis pointed out years ago, the Protestantism of Hughes' day was not the ecumenical, Irenic Protestantism that we're familiar with today. There's a very fine book on New York City called The New Metropolis by a man named Edward Spann. And he talks about the whole expansion of New York City in the years when Hughes was here. It's just accidental that his book covers almost exactly the same parameters as Hughes' tenure as bishop and then the first archbishop. But he points out New York in those days, he said, it was the capital of Protestant America. It was the headquarters of things like the American Bible Society. And Spahn, who's not a Catholic, points out there was no doubt that Protestant leadership regarded Catholicism as an alien and inferior religion. And that, I think, you have to keep in mind when you see Hughes accused of having this ghetto mentality. You really need to judge him in the context of his time. And by that, I don't mean you need to be uncritical. He had many, many flaws and failings. Among other things, he had a great ability to invent or deny reality. But that his self-description of bishop in chief, that would tell you how he conceived of his role. Now, the fact that he did that, it gave, in a sense, Catholics a unified leadership. But I'd say it also, because he was so headstrong and so autocratic, it deprived him and the New York Catholic community of the benefit of a more collegial, collaborative form of leadership.
And one of the things that he helped to start was this really separate Catholic world in New York, with the schools, the hospitals, the orphanages, the homes for young women, for young men, the girls, you know, camps for boys and girls. It's amazing when you look back how extensive that network was.
Yes, it was. And, for example, the first Catholic charitable institution in New York City was not a school. It was an orphan asylum in 1817, because there was such an urgent need for that kind of institution. The only other orphan asylum was a public orphan asylum, which in effect meant a Protestant orphan asylum. And Catholic youngsters who were sent there would almost certainly be lost to the faith.
Now, there are many parts of this story, and we'll get back to some of the Episcopal leadership in New York, but I thought for a moment we could focus on some of the prominent converts who have played a role in development of the Church of New York. Dorothy Day comes to mind. Who are some of the other people that you would mention?
Well, no, I'm glad you brought that up, because they do play a role, I'd say, all out of proportion to their numbers, as I suppose they have everywhere in the English-speaking world. And I suppose the most prominent of the early converts would be Elizabeth Ann Seton, who of course founded the Sisters of Charity. But I find it interesting that all through the 19th century, there are a number of women religious who either were founders of new communities or major superiors who were converts from Protestantism. For example, when the Sisters of Charity split off from the Mother House in Emmitsburg, the first superior of the new community in New York was Elizabeth Boyle, who was herself a convert. And there's a whole long list of people like that. For example, Rose Hawthorne Lathrop, the daughter of Nathaniel Hawthorne,
yeah,
who founded those Dominican Sisters for the Relief of Incurable Cancer. Remember, it's still a largely immigrant community which doesn't produce much in the way of intellectual leaders. And that, again, is where the converts play a considerable role. I'm thinking, particularly in New York, Orestes Brownson and Isaac Hecker, who were, I'd say, the two outstanding intellectual figures in certainly the New York Church and probably the American Catholic Church in the mid-19th century. You mentioned Dorothy Day. You could include someone like Thomas Merton as well. There were two other people, converts. One was Levi Silliman Imes, who had been the Protestant bishop of North Carolina, became a Catholic. In those days, because he was married, there was no possibility he could be ordained. So what he did is he became very active in the work of the St. Vincent de Paul Society. He was very active in that, which was the chief Catholic charitable organization in the city. And together with another convert, a man named Henry Anderson, who had been a professor at Columbia, the two of them were largely responsible for this child-caring institution called the Catholic Protectory, which was located where Parkchester is today. And that became certainly one of the largest child-caring institutions in the country. When it closed in 1939, well, probably, you know, it was past its peak then, but at its peak, it had close to 3,000 children, both boys and girls, in that institution. Again, it's just mind-boggling to think at one point the Christian Brothers had 80 brothers assigned to that institution. So, and again, that's another thing to keep in mind. This school system, these hospitals, these child-caring institutions, they could never have been built without the women religious and the brothers as well. I mean,
yeah, that's a part of the story I'd like to discuss. You know, we talk about the archdiocese in history, but the religious orders, as you say, played such an important role in creating these institutions. Now, what was their relationship like with the hierarchy? I mean, you had, you know, the Jesuits here, the Christian Brothers, all of these orders of nuns. Did they work well with the leadership?
I suppose, I think for the most part they did, and it was a world where, on the surface, women were supposed to be, you know, very deferential and obedient. But there were a number of instances where that certainly didn't happen. There's a marvelous story about these the German Franciscan Sisters of the Poor, who opened a St. Francis Hospital around 1864 or 65, founded by Mother Frances Chevrier, who's since been beatified. But they was, because they were women religious, they were supposed to be somehow or other under the supervision of the Redemptorists, who were largely Germans. And at one point, the Redemptorists said, that hospital should only be for Catholics. You can't admit non-Catholics. Mother Chevrier happened to be in the city at the time. She wrote this beautiful letter to Archbishop McCluskey, saying, if that's what we have to do, you can have the hospital. We're not going to run a hospital on that basis. You can have the building, you can have the bedding, you can have everything. But we will not run a hospital on that basis because it's contrary to what St. Francis would want. They won. And there are a number of instances like that. There's a funny story about Spellman when he was going to, there was some major change supposed to take place at St. Vincent's Hospital. Now this is, I suppose, in the 50s or 60s. And the superior of the Sisters of Charity then was Mother Loretta Burnett. I remember hearing a story from one of the people who was present. Spellman fell asleep during this presentation. And Mother Loretta Burnett just came over and shook him and said, wake up, you're the one that has to make this decision here. And the sister doctor said, nobody had any doubt who really had the authority in that room. So, you know, on the surface, it was all a man's world. But I think, you know, any bishop realized how much he depended on these women religious. And another thing to keep in mind is, for example, by 1900, the Sisters of Charity numbered about 1,200 women religious. They ran something like 60, 70 different institutions. Huh. The woman who was their major religious superior, I think, without exaggeration, she probably had more responsibility, more authority, than any other woman in New York City. When you think of, you know, what she was responsible, I mean, even men at women's colleges in those days had men presidents. So that's something that's often forgotten, the role that some of these religious superiors played in a man's world.
Now, often in discussing a history of an archdiocese, you focus on the bishops and the archbishops, and I think it's important, as you know, to also remember these people, these unsung folks who, we may not know their names, but were so important in the development of the diocese. But we should talk about some of the big names, the great figures, people like Cardinal Spellman, who was called for much of his tenure sort of the American Pope. How long was he actually Archbishop of New York?
Well, from 1939 to 1967. And in some ways, I suppose, after Hughes, he'd be the most significant Archbishop of New York. The last of the great, you know, brick-and-mortar bishops who put up, and actually, he didn't open that many churches, new parishes. One of the things I found as I was doing the research for this book is the infrastructure of the church in New York, at least Manhattan and the Bronx, was pretty well set by 1929. There were relatively few new parishes founded after that date, except, of course, in the suburbs. But Spellman's, you know, building was largely increasing the school system, putting additions on existing schools, new hospitals, things like that. Again, there's so many different sides to Spellman, and there's no good biography. Robert Gannon wrote that authorized biography, which is, people laugh at it, but it's worth looking at. It's full of information, and precisely because it is an authorized biography, it's good to remember these are the things that he was proud of.
Right.
Before that book was published, he brought it to a man who had one time, Joe Egan, who had been professor of church history at Dunwoody. And Egan saw the manuscript and said, that book, that should never be published. And Spellman said, why? He said, it'll be a primer for every cleric who wants to get ahead for the next 100 years. But he didn't see it. This is what he was proud of. But again, he's a, you know, there is, you mentioned the American Pope. That's the title of a biography by John Cooney, which is an awful book. The research was largely done on the telephone, if you just look at the footnotes.
Mm-hmm.
And he has, you know, just such a obvious bias against Spellman. It's a very poorly done book. There's no good biography, like Hughes. But again, Spellman said one time, no one will ever do a good biography of me because I did most of my work on the phone.
So he didn't write much down, yeah.
Or he destroyed a lot of what he did write down.
Write down, yeah.
Which, was, again, was like that you know, that old Irish mentality, you know, the, you don't want the neighbors to know the father's drinking again or something. it's that mentality. But again, there's so many different sides to him. During the Second World War, he becomes a very, you know, potent symbol of American patriotism at a time when there was still this lingering doubt about whether Catholics are really to be trusted in with political office and so on. One of the great tragedies is he never could see the difference between the Vietnam War and World War II.
Right.
But like many people of his generation. I mean, he lived into a world that he just didn't understand. But again, he's an ambivalent figure. Like at Vatican II, he was so adamantly opposed to the liturgical changes. On the other hand, he was responsible for bringing John Courtney Murray
sure.
to the Second Vatican Council.
No, he's a fascinating figure and one of these great figures in the history of New York. And it's amazing when you think of, you look at the history of New York and how many big figures in American Catholicism were figures on the New York stage. As you said, Dorothy Day, Thomas Merton, John Hughes, Archbishop Hughes, somebody else, Francis Duffy, who you recently wrote about in our pages, who early in his career helped start the New York Review at St. Joseph's Seminary up in New York and later became known for being, he was a chaplain in World War One, correct?
Yes,
yeah,
yes.
Fighting Francis Duffy?
Yes, and again, a remarkable figure. And then after the war, he was pastor of St. of Holy Cross on 42nd Street, an immensely popular figure, and as popular with non-Catholics as he was with Catholics. Another area where he came into the public forum was in 1928, the time of when Al Smith ran for president.
Oh, sure.
The year before, there was that famous article that appeared in the Atlantic Monthly saying that Al Smith, you know, a man named Charles Marshall, who was a respected lawyer, no, it wasn't some redneck, and Marshall said, we can't have a president in the White House because he would have to take his orders from the Pope. He would have to follow what's in these papal encyclicals. And poor Smith had no, supposedly when Smith heard that, he said to someone, what the hell's an encyclical? But he collaborated with Duffy in writing a response, which was a remarkably effective response to that accusation. And if you look at it, I don't think it's an exaggeration to say in many ways he anticipates what John Courtney Murray would do 30 years later.
Now, you mentioned Al Smith. Who are some of the other notable lay Catholics who came out of New York, the New York political system? I'll offer a couple examples that you mentioned in your book. One was the first mayor of New York City was William Grace, who was a Catholic.
Yes.
And then Honest John Kelly was the first Catholic leader of Tammany Hall. And Tammany Hall, of course, would become a place where there were many Catholic leaders
right.
over the years. Now, what was their relationship with the church? Did they take their marching orders from the bishops?
I don't think so. For example, William Grace was elected as mayor and then broke with Tammany Hall, to his credit. Now, the connection with Kelly and the church, I think, was closer because he was married to McCluskey's niece. But again, you know, they called him Honest John. They usually put in quotation marks, and it's a relative term because, remember, he succeeded Boss Tweed. So, I mean, just how authentic that was, I don't know. And then later on, when someone like Croker was the head of Tammany Hall, again, I think he pretty much did what he pleased.
And of course, you know, going up to today, you have Catholic mayors like Rudolph Giuliani. So
yes.
There have been Catholics in public life here in New York for a very long time.
Right, but again, you know, politicians can count votes. And as long as the Catholics in New York, or particularly Irish Catholics, constituted a large segment of the voting population, politicians were very concerned about the views of the Archbishop. After all, in the early 20th century, they referred to 452 Madison Avenue as the powerhouse.
The powerhouse, yeah. We'll talk a little bit about this in a few moments, but New York does have a reputation these days, as like other northeastern dioceses, as being more conservative in a number of ways. Yet, as you point out in your book, some of the liturgical renewal, for example, that came about at Vatican II, there were a couple parishes here in New York that were doing some pretty innovative liturgies, one being St. Paul the Apostle here in Midtown, and also Corpus Christi. Maybe you can talk about those two examples.
Well, I would start off by saying there are exceptions to the rule. But St. Paul the Apostle, remember, that's the Church of Hecker and the Paulus. And it was in many ways the model, for even more than the cathedral, for New York churches. They had an excellent choir, an excellent liturgy, a good catechetical program, they realized the importance of the press. I mean, the Catholic world for many years was one of the most influential Catholic publications. So in many ways, and also they were instrumental in introducing Gregorian chant, and what's even more surprising, choral music, getting Catholics to sing, which is really quite an achievement. As far as Corpus Christi is concerned, in the 30s and 40s, when George Barry Ford was the pastor, again, you know, he was regarded as a maverick, and he was always in hot water with the chancery office. But he introduced this business, as I know you're well aware, of a dialogue mass where a priest was celebrating mass, another priest was in the pulpit who was translating into English the prayers of the mass and the scripture readings, everything else. That for its day was a remarkably innovative thing to do. But he was forever running afoul of the chancery office. There's a famous occasion when Riverside Church had an anniversary and Ford sent a bouquet of flowers. And he got in hot water with the chancellor, who was the future Cardinal McIntyre. And he accused him of promoting non-Catholic worship because he sent a bouquet of flowers to Riverside Church. So that would tell you what Ford was up against.
Let's move ahead a little bit and talk about, you know, New York life in the New York Catholic Church today. Now, we've talked from the beginning about the influence of the Irish in the New York Church. I mean, other than you said Archbishop Dubois, there has been no other, every New York Archbishop has been Irish. There yes. has, as Jim Fisher said at this event last night, been no ethnic succession in the New York Archdiocese. The diocese is obviously demographically much more diverse. Why do you think there is still this kind of, we still have this connection to the Irish leadership?
Well, I suppose even as the numbers of non-Irish clergy increased, the Irish still produced more priests, I'd say, than any other ethnic group, I think. The other thing I would just point out, too, throughout the 19th century, one of the things that was distinctive about the Irish laity, is that they were so supportive of other ethnic groups. The Italians, the Germans, not the Germans, but the Italians, the French, African Americans, the Spanish, the Czechs. There are numerous cases where these ethnic groups founded their own parishes. They couldn't make a go of them financially. It was the Irish who saved the day. So what was distinctive, I say, was not just their numbers and not just their support for their own parishes, but their willingness to support the fledgling churches of other ethnic groups. For example, the first church in New York for African Americans was St. Martin de Porres, St. Benedict the Moor, excuse me. But that was founded in 1883 with money left by Tom Farrell, who had been the pastor of St. Joseph's Church. Farrell, again, you talk about unsung heroes. Farrell was a remarkable figure in his own way. He was that rarest of rare birds, a Catholic abolitionist. And after the Civil War, he and a friend of his from Brooklyn, Sylvester Malone, took a trip through the South. They were particularly interested in the plight of the freed slaves. And the Bishop of Richmond was so upset, he accused the two of them of what he called negrophily, you know, love of blacks, as if it were a crime or a sin. But anyway, Farrell left $5,000 in his will to start the first black parish north of the Mason-Dixon line. And there was a stipulation in the will, if it wasn't used for that purpose within 3 years, it would go to a non-Catholic charity. McCluskey waited the full 3 years, and then rather than lose the money, he reluctantly agreed to start this black parish. But it was staffed by Irish-American priests from the very beginning. I'd say, obviously, with a name like mine, I'd be prejudiced, maybe I am, but I think one of the things to keep in mind, which seems so obvious to me, is the generosity of the Irish to these other ethnic groups. And again, when you had the beginnings of the large-scale Italian immigration, the 1880s, 1890s, many of the priests who first ministered to the Italians were Irish-Americans who had been educated in Rome. And again, the parallel with that would be the 1950s and 60s, the time of the big Puerto Rican migration, when there was a concerted effort made to provide Spanish-speaking priests. So many of them were Irish-Americans. And some of them have been 50 years in the South Bronx. And there again, that's another aspect of Spellman. There's so many different sides to him. I mean, you know, I mentioned the Vietnam War as in many ways, you know, such a sad end for him with the Calvary Cemetery strike. On the other hand, there were situations where he was very, very good. And in recognizing the need to respond to these hundreds of thousands of Hispanic immigrants, he did a very good job there.
Now, we're going to move ahead to today, where, you know, New York Catholics play still a very prominent role in the city here. And I thought, you addressed this near the end of your book, one event that made that very apparent was 9/11. And where you had stories of all of these firefighters and police officers that were all of Catholics, Irish, Italian descent. You had the story of Father Michael Judge, who was the chaplain of the fire department, and they brought his body to the steps of St. Peter's, which you mentioned earlier. So that history of New York was of Catholics in New York was very real at that point.
Oh, I think that's very true. And even last week when Pope Benedict went to Ground Zero, you could see so many of the people, a representative group whom he met, but so many of them appeared to be Catholic. And that would be representative, I would think, of so many of the victims in that occasion.
Now, finally, there's a lot we could discuss here, but I think we can end by just, you know, we're talking about New York here, and we don't want to be too New York-centric. America is a national magazine. What influence has the New York Church had on the American church, both in terms of personnel who have been sent from New York elsewhere, but also in terms of, you know, the major figures and movements that have emerged from this city?
I'm sorry you asked me that question. Because in many ways, I think, for much of the 20th century, I think the church in the Midwest, in many ways, was more progressive than we were. And in terms of influence, well, Spellman was something of a kingmaker. He was responsible for people like Cardinal O'Boyle in Washington and Cardinal McIntyre in Los Angeles, Cardinal O'Hara in Philadelphia. But Jerry Fogey, in his book on the Vatican, the American Hierarchy, he points out how a group of Midwestern bishops resisted that and tried to keep Spellman within bounds. They had what they called the Hindenburg Line. and with the exception of McIntyre, they confined his influence to the East Coast. I realize that's an inadequate answer and a flip answer, but quite frankly, I just don't know how to answer another.
No, it's a good issue. I mean, but you do have figures like, as we discussed before, Dorothy Day and Thomas Merton, people who perhaps not associated with the formal hierarchical church, but figures that did come out of New York.
Well, thank you for answering the question better than I was able to do. It's interesting, actually, when you get down to it now, the number of people who were not native New Yorkers, but some, at least for some time in their life, were associated with New York Catholicism. You mentioned too, Dorothy Day is maybe the most prominent, but there are others like John LaFarge.
Sure, yeah.
He was not a native New Yorker, and yet he was a pioneer in promoting better race relations, and 20 or 30 years, New York was the center of his activity.
He was a Jesuit editor here at American Magazine.
Yes. There's another remarkable figure, a Paulist priest named John J. Burke, who in the 1920s and 30s was the General Secretary of the USCC, which was the predecessor of the present NCCB, whatever it is. But he, again, was an extremely capable figure, for example, in trying to work out some sort of diplomatic settlement with the Mexican government when it was persecuting the church. He was also very much interested in social reform. So there, he was a native New Yorker, born of Irish parents. Most of his work was done in Washington, but there certainly was a very real New York connection.
And you talked about Orestes Brownson and yes. Isaac Hecker, and these are individuals who, I guess it's the story of New York, is that there are not a lot of people here in New York today who are native-born New Yorkers, but people who come to the city. And that's the case with these folks as well. So, Monsignor Shelley, we want to thank you for addressing this this fascinating topic. And your book, again, is the Bicentennial History of the Archdiocese of New York. And that's published by a French publisher. You'll have to pronounce it for me.
Edition de Signe, who have quite a long list of diocesan histories they published in Europe as well as here. I'd just like to thank you for inviting me to come here this afternoon, for giving me this opportunity to speak not only about the book, but also about the Archdiocese of New York and its people, past and present.
Thank you for joining us for this week's edition of the American Magazine podcast. This, the week of May 26th, is the last regular issue before our summer schedule, so our podcast will be appearing on a bi-weekly basis in conjunction with the magazine, which is also appearing twice a month. So we'll be back for the June 9th through 16th issue. So in a couple weeks, we'll have another interview for you. So I hope you can join us. In the meantime, you can learn more about us at americamagazine.podbean.com. This is Tim Reedy for American Magazine.